Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And to wrap up our show today on crossing the divide, we are going to rewind almost 100 years. For African Americans in the 1920s and 30s, segregation lurked all over. And that included the nightlife in Seattle, especially if you were or wanted to go see a black musician. But on a little sliver of Jackson Street, African American musicians found a home. The Black and Tan Club was not only a place for the likes of a young Ray Charles or Quincy Jones to grow, but also that rare spot that welcomed an audience of all races. Paul DeBarros is a music writer for the Seattle Times and author of Jackson Street After Hours, The Roots of Jazz in Seattle, and he shared his story with us.
There were two entertainment districts. There was the White Entertainment District and the Black Entertainment District. The White Entertainment District was along First Avenue. And in downtown, there were huge theaters like the Pantages Theater, which is gone now, the Paramount. A lot of them built in the 1920s, but some of them, like the Moore, going all the way back to the early 1900s. Seattle had been a major stop on the vaudeville circuit.
Georgie Porgy is a guy who is very bashful and so shy. The ladies prize him. They idolize him. You can find him most anywhere.
Black people could go to those shows, depending on which theater they were at. But black performers weren't allowed to play in those theaters downtown. They didn't play at the Paramount. They didn't play on KOL radio. They didn't play at the fancy clubs on 1st or on 4th. They were not permitted to play there. The Musicians Union, Local 76, like many unions around the country, with the exception of the one in New York, was segregated. And it wasn't just against black people. It was a white union. If you were a Native American or Filipino, you were also not welcome. So African Americans formed their own union, the Local 493. So it was never written down on paper, but the areas of town that were reserved for 493 and politely left to themselves was the area around 12th and Jackson, the Central District, and Madison. They were reserved officially by the unions for the African American Union. As far as we know, Russell Noodle Smith started the club. He didn't just open the Black and Tan, he opened a lot of clubs, and he had a lot to protect. The thing you have to understand about Washington, even before the 1920s, alcohol was illegal. We had prohibition here in 1916. So Noodles had a lot to protect. He was running illegal businesses. Joe Derensburg, who was a wonderful, wonderful musician, said the Black and Tan, during the years that he worked there, had this elaborate system where the booze was all hidden behind panels, and it came down in tubes to fill up people's glasses. So when the cops came, this red light would go off, and all the tubes would get sucked back up into the wall, and it would all be hidden again. It was like a movie, you know, from the 20s. So what you had is a place where mostly African-American people were going to basically just have a good time in the neighborhood, which they didn't feel comfortable doing or weren't allowed to do in the white neighborhoods. The Black and Tan was a really small place. If you walk south on 12th Avenue South, past Jackson Street, there's a what used to be a purple door. I think the last time I looked, it was still purple, but very faded. That's the door downstairs. And the club occupied the basement part of that building that's on the corner where there's now a Vietnamese grocery store. Mostly, the bands that played there were combos. And when we're talking about the famous big name first tier players, somebody like a Coleman Hawkins or Duke Ellington or Ben Webster, if they came by the club, it would have been after their major gig at a place like the Pantages Theater or the Civic Auditorium. And, you know, jazz musicians, it's like the gig's over, but the night is young. So especially if you're a young man, and most of them were, it's like, well, where's the action? And, oh man, it's at the Black and Tan. Let's go down there and see if this town has any cats that can cut us. And it was like a cutting contest, a, you know, jam session. And they would go and jam there till 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. I think it's true to say that those scenes in general offered a public space that was much more open to the integration of black and white than the country at large. And that speaks to jazz's forward thinking and getting the ball rolling much earlier in terms of the integration of the races than the rest of the culture. Jazz was way ahead. If you love jazz in the 1930s even, you probably thought, wow, African Americans are like really smart, creative people. They would have to be to make this music. So suddenly this horrible image of African American people that was prevalent among so many whites was just washed away. Because once you heard Lester Young or Count Basie or Fats Waller, you'd be shaking your head and saying, wow, that's pretty amazing.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you.
So the black and tan's no exception to that. I think it's a place where black and white could mix on the basis of all respecting this African-American bred music, jazz. And let's not leave out the Japanese Americans here, because, you know, the Central District was a really mixed neighborhood, especially before the internment of the Japanese. It was Japanese, it was Jewish, it was Italian, and it was black. So it was definitely a space where the races mixed. Just the name Black and Tan. I mean, Duke Ellington wrote Black and Tan Fantasy, which is one of the greatest pieces of music in jazz history, about this contrast in white and black culture. But my take on it is the average person thought of black and tan. It was a place where white people and black people could mix in a relaxed way in a social club atmosphere and dig it. Going through the newspapers, every day of the newspapers from 1900 to 1960, the PI and the Times, there are all these reviews of these third-rate chamber groups playing European music badly. And there are no mentions of the black and tan. There's nobody who recognizes that young geniuses like Ray Charles and Quincy Jones and Ernestine Anderson and later Floyd Standifer, Buddy Catlett, are even in their midst. They are completely invisible to the public at large. The only people that know about this at all are the people in the community itself, in the African-American community in the Central District, the Japanese-Americans are going to the clubs, and the few white people that are going to the clubs. So just the fact that these places existed allowed the flowering of an American culture. That's huge. If they hadn't been there, if the cops had come down and said, like they might have in Mississippi, and said, not only can you not play downtown, you can't play here either. Where would those people have gone? Would we have had the music they created? Would we have had Little Richard, whose first record was produced by Bumps Blackwell, who came up in this town and who hired Ernestine Anderson and hired Buddy Catlett and hired Quincy Jones and had him playing behind Billie Holiday when Quincy was 15 years old? It's a huge, huge contribution to the cultural history of Seattle and the cultural history of America. And I think the other thing that really set Seattle apart is reflected in the music that racial tolerance and that racial mixing gave rise to. Because the people that came out of here in those days, particularly Quincy and Ray, their music is marked by a refusal to acknowledge racial boundaries. Quincy and Ray and Bumps Blackwell had a completely different attitude. Like Ray later, why can't I sing country music? And Quincy Jones would play at Broadmoor and play a schottische, you know, like a European dance. He didn't see anything weird about it. It's all music. I want to cross these boundaries. And look what we got, you know, from him we got Michael Jackson, you know, because he produced Thriller. We got this serious melding and fusion culturally from those people. And I honestly believe that it was Seattle that helped make them that way.
Paul DeBarros is the author of Jackson Street After Hours, The Roots of Jazz in Seattle, and he covers music for the Seattle Times.